We're looking at the final time, life of Joseph, life of Jacob, all of Joseph's brothers as well. Worth reflecting just where we've come in Genesis, not just in terms of, we started where in chapter 37, but it's worth reflecting where the book of Genesis starts and where it ends. What does Genesis start off with? It starts off with new life. God speaks and all sorts of things, animals, plants, light, God creates. The book of Genesis starts bursting with expectation. And then even ever since Genesis 3, there's been a promise. People have been waiting. A child is going to be born. He's coming. Well, that waiting period has been full of twists and turns. So what you'd expect in Genesis is for the book to be building up to a huge crescendo. It's all coming to one great triumphal act. But instead, when you get to the end of Genesis, all you get is the death of two of our leading characters. You get this story of Jacob being embalmed, this long period of mourning. And then the very last verse in the whole of Genesis sees Joseph in a coffin in Egypt. Isn't that all just a little bit deflating? Considering where Genesis started, is that really a great way to end this story, this book? One of the things I've noticed about reading biographies is I'm able to predict how biographies end. Every single biography I've read, do you know what happens at the end? They die. I can always get that one right, that prediction. Death just puts a bit of a dampener on it all, doesn't it? Have all those hopes, all that new life, has it all just petered out, come to nothing? Is this just like a marathon runner who's bitten off more than he can chew, and those last few miles just limping, hobbling over the line? So it all just petered out and gone out with a bit of a whimper. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Because although death is very present in this chapter, it's a chapter brimming with hope and expectancy, even in death, that God is working. And there are three specific hopes in this chapter that I want to draw your attention to, and they're three hopes that every believer, every Christian can hold on to. Here's the first one. There is hope of a future inheritance. And the verses for that, they start back in chapter 49, verse 29, and that takes us into 50, verse 14. So at the end of chapter 49, Jacob speaks his final words. He's asking to be buried with his fathers in a cave, in a field, in the land of Canaan. If you've been here with us previous weeks, you might be thinking, haven't we been here before? Hasn't he said this already? And he has. It's back in chapter 47, verses 29 and 30. 47, verses 29 and 30, he calls Joseph to him and basically says, please don't bury me in Egypt. Let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt. Now, sometimes as people get older, they get forgetful. They start repeating things. Is that what's happening here? Is he just repeating something because he's forgotten he only just said it? That's not the case, actually. It's because he's obsessed with something else. It's because he's obsessed, he's thinking, it's on his mind. I was sent out to run an errand last week. I had to go to shops and I had a shopping list, and there was one thing on the shopping list. Do you know what happened? All I had to get was digestive biscuits for the base of a banoffee pie. One thing. But when I got to the shop and I saw all the reduced stickers on all sorts of random things, I had a whole bundle of reduced price yogurts and sausage rolls, and I took my eye off the ball a bit and I came in with the wrong type of biscuits. You know, what happened? I was more excited by reduced price sausage rolls than I was by getting that one thing. Jacob's just showing us here what's on his mind, what gets his pulse racing, what he's thinking. That's why he repeats this. Because that cave, that burial ground, is the last remaining stake in the ground of Canaan. That's where they've been. But the whole family has moved to Egypt. And the only thing they have left in Canaan is that burial plot. So it takes on a huge symbolic significance for Jacob. We read about it in Joseph's death as well. In chapter 50, verse 25, Joseph's thinking about the same thing too. He wants his bones to be carried up from Egypt to Canaan. The same thing matters to Joseph as it does to Jacob. But why? Why do they both care about where they're buried so much? It's because that land represents a future. Not just for their children, their physical descendants, although that is true. It represents a hope that reaches beyond the grave. A hope for the soul, a hope for the promised land. That's a hope that's sometimes very missing from our day and age today. There are some funerals that just seem to be completely devoid of hope, where there's nothing to look forward to. Some funerals where there are words of remembrance for the person who's died, where nice poetry is read, but there's no hope. No hope that the people who are gathering to mourn will ever see this person again, that they'll be reunited, and no hope for the person themselves. Well, Christians mourn at a funeral. Death is a terrible enemy. It doesn't mean we just come in all jolly and pretend everything. No, death is a horrible thing. But when a Christian dies, it can be an extremely moving event for the believers who are left. Because we weep, but not without hope. You know, a grieving Christian wife can look forward to seeing her Christian husband again. A grieving child, a grieving Christian child, can look forward to seeing the parent they've lost again. There is hope. They're going to share the new heavens and the new earth together. That friendship will pick up where it left off. We'll be reminiscing about our old lives on earth together, enjoying a world even more beautiful than Eden, together. For Christians, there is hope in death. For Jacob, he was hoping, in terms of the immediate future, he was hoping for Canaan. He knew that land had been promised to his descendants. But how much greater will our final home be than just a plot of land on this earth? Jesus said, and we've got to take this literally, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." You know, we're going to rule the world one day. There will be a new heavens and a new earth. We will have a crown of righteousness, a crown of glory, and we will have friendships there that will never be broken by death. Whereas every relationship here between Christians, whether it's Christian friends, whether it's Christian husband and wife, whatever the relationship is, unless Jesus comes again, it will be broken by that terrible enemy. But we'll be reunited. We will be together. There is hope. People talk about euthanasia. What euthanasia means? It means a good death. That's what it literally means. But a good death, dying well, isn't ultimately about whether we've had a long life or a short one, whether we've had a painful death or a pain-free one where you just go peacefully, whether it's sudden or whether it's protracted and drawn out. Dying well is dying with a hope of the inheritance to come. And Jacob and Joseph for showing us how to do that. When we talk about hope, we're talking about proper confidence, though, certainty. Jacob and Joseph has that. Jacob in particular has this confidence because he's already seen so many of God's promises fulfilled in his life. Back in Genesis 46, God gave Jacob four promises. If you turn back to Genesis 46 just for a moment, there are four promises in Genesis 46, verses 3 and 4. We looked at them a few weeks ago. I want to say to you that out of those four promises, 2.5 of them have been fulfilled. I think, how can half a promise be fulfilled? Well, I will explain that. But I want to just pick up on those four promises because this is at the root of Jacob's confidence. Here's the first promise God gives him. I will make of you a great nation. Well, that's already started to happen. Jacob has gone to Egypt, and they're told that as the people of Israel grow, they multiply. This is Genesis 47, verse 27, if you want to look that up. The nation is growing and growing, more and more of them. That promise is being fulfilled. Yes, it will continue to grow, but Jacob can say, yes, God kept that promise. And then there's a second promise. There's, I will go down with you to Egypt in verse 4. And I have no doubt, if you'd asked Jacob on his deathbed, did he do it? Did God go to Egypt with you? Or did he stay in Canaan? He would have said, yes, he came with me. That promise has been fulfilled for him as well. So that's 2 out of 2. The third one, still in those verses in Genesis 46, Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. This is the one I'm saying is half completed. Because Jacob's gone to Egypt, he's met Joseph again, Joseph is there at his deathbed. But the reason I'm saying it's only half completed is because Jacob has to actually die first. So in a sense, he can't see it completely fulfilled because he's got to die so that Joseph can actually close his eyes in death. But Joseph's there. He's confident that's going to happen. So then you come to the fourth promise. I know I'm taking it slightly in reverse order, but verse 4, chapter 46, verse 4, I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. That's the one he hasn't seen happen yet. But he can be supremely confident, of course that's going to happen, because all the other promises have been kept too. For us, sometimes we focus on the things God has not done for us yet. That's the wrong approach. Don't ask yourself, what hasn't God done for me yet? What are those prayers that he hasn't answered yet? So think about what he has done for you. Think about the promises he has kept in your life so far. Because that's what gives you great confidence for the ones that haven't happened yet. And that's what will give you great confidence that he will take care of you in death as well. So Jacob's deathbed isn't a place of despair and defeat. It's a place of great hope and confidence in that inheritance to come. Secondly, in these verses, there's a hope of future reconciliation. And that's chapter 50, that's verses 15 through to 21. Back at the end of chapter 49, we've said Jacob breathed his last, that's verse 33, and he passes away. And at the start of chapter 50, Joseph mourns, he weeps over his father's face. He goes in verses 4 and 5, he goes to Pharaoh and says, please, can I take the body? Can I take him back to Canaan to bury him? And in verse 6, Pharaoh agrees. So this great crowd of them head back to Canaan. And there's further mourning and grieving there. And then in verse 12, verse 13 as well, I think that Jacob's sons bury him in this cave of the field at Machpelah, the place Jacob's asked to be buried. But then something else surprising happens. So if you've been following this story as it's gone on all its twists and turns, you've been following the interaction between Joseph and his brothers. And remember that a few chapters ago, Joseph has gone to great lengths to show his brothers that he doesn't hold a grudge against them. for all the things they did to him. They did some awful stuff, but he's made it very clear. This is all back in chapter 45. When he lets them know that it's him, and they're dismayed at his presence, it's chapter 45, verse 3, Joseph says, "Don't be grieved or angry. God sent me before you to preserve life. It wasn't you who sent me here, it was God." Chapter 45, verse 11, he says, "Go back and get Jacob. Go and bring the whole household. I'll take care of you during this famine." Chapter 45, verse 15, he kisses all his brothers. He weeps over them. He gives them a place to live. And then for 17 years now, they've been there, shepherding their flocks in Goshen, living, becoming prosperous again. 17 years. Surely, after 17 years, the past has been put behind them now. But no. Jacob's death seems to bring it all back up again. Sometimes a death in the family can do that. Changes the dynamics of a relationship. Sometimes it can be for good that frosty relationships can start to thaw. Sometimes though, the distance between people can grow greater. For these brothers, you can see the effect it has on them. In verse 15, after their father's died, they say, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." Maybe this last 17 years, maybe it's all just been an act from Joseph. Maybe he was only doing it because he didn't want to upset Dad. But now Dad's off the scene, is he going to turn on us? Is he going to show what he really thinks about us? So what they do, they send a messenger. The fact that they send a messenger again shows there's a bit of distance that's come between them. And verse 16 and 17, they say, "Joseph, Dad said before he died that you should forgive us for the evil that we did to you." Now, when you read various commentators on this, they all seem to take the view that they've made that up. That because we don't have a record of Jacob saying anything like that. Well, that's possible. I don't know. But I don't think we should assume it, because you've got in there men like Judah. And as we've seen Judah, we followed him through. What a man he has become, full of integrity and honesty. And you know, what a good guy he becomes. So maybe Jacob did really say this. I don't know. What this does do, though, is it gives us an insight into these brothers' feelings. Shows us how they felt. How they feel? They're nervous. They still don't really know where they stand with their brother. They still don't know. Am I really forgiven? Has real reconciliation taken place? They still don't know. Now, Joseph, in this story, remember, Joseph for us is something of a picture of Jesus. And we can feel like that in our relationship with Jesus too. We can ask that same question. Am I really reconciled to Christ? Has he really forgiven me? Or is he just saying it? Will he turn on me at some point in the future? There's a lesson for us to learn here. When you look at Joseph, you read this story, you think, of course Joseph meant it. Of course he did. Isn't it obvious? Look at the lengths he went to provide for them. Look at his character. Look at who Joseph is. He's a man of such integrity and faithfulness. A man who keeps his word. A man of honour. How could they doubt him? We do that to Christ when we take our eyes off who he is. We forget the integrity and the honesty and the faithfulness of Christ. And we start reminding ourselves and thinking of our own sins. That's when we start to doubt. When we have those doubts, we need to remind ourselves of the lengths Christ went to show us, to prove to us he loves us. And we need to think as well about the trustworthiness of Jesus. Jesus never says things for the sake of it. Never has ulterior motives. I suspect that's when you look back at Joseph now in verse 17, you see Joseph weeping as Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Because for him, it just brings it all up and he realizes all this time they've been afraid of me. They haven't been able to trust me. They've been wondering if I've just been biding my time, waiting to strike them down after my father dies. Well, these brothers ask for forgiveness. In verse 18, they tell Joseph they're his servants. And verse 19, 20, Joseph reassures them again. It's actually the same things he said to them back in chapter 45. He says, look, it's okay. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. Don't be afraid. He says that twice. Don't be afraid. In verse 21, I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. See, in one sense, you could have said to those brothers, you don't need to be told again. Joseph's already told you. Isn't he kind? In a way, he just comforts them and reassures them. And God's kind to us in that way too. Sometimes God says the same things to us again and again because we need to keep on hearing them. We need to keep on being reminded. Don't be afraid. I will comfort you. I will care for you. I will keep you. There's something of a reconciliation going on here with these brothers. Jesus is reuniting a family that's been divided. It's taken a long time, but he brings hope here into what would have been a hopeless family situation. When you think about what those brothers have done to him, you would have looked on as a neutral observer years back and thought, how could that family ever be brought together again? How could Joseph ever love them? How could those brothers ever trust Joseph again? Maybe your family's been something like that as well. You know, in those sorts of divisions, family where perhaps people haven't spoken for years. Maybe your family's got those awkward, distant relationships where people don't really trust each other. Maybe it goes beyond your family. Maybe there are Christians that you know and you still believe they are genuine Christians, but you've had disagreements with them over the years. And sometimes, like these brothers, there's a place for taking action, for reaching out, for talking to them, to trying to resolve those differences, to sort things out. But sometimes there's nothing you can do. Sometimes, actually, reconciliation isn't perfect in life. See, I don't know. What we're not told here is, how did the brothers respond? Did they really trust Joseph after this? Did it really completely heal that relationship? I think this story is a reminder to us that reconciliation in this life exists, and it is real, and it's possible when Jesus does it, but it's still not perfect. We still live in a broken world. 17 years have passed, and still those brothers are not fully reconciled. Still they can't trust him. I think that's helpful because that's what real Christian life is like. Our relationships, even with other Christians sometimes, they aren't perfect. And they're not what we'd want them to be. And sometimes there is nothing we can do. Sometimes, even like Joseph, you can say all the right things, the things that need to be said, and it still doesn't fully heal that relationship. But the story does also point us towards the great hope of future reconciliation. That everyone who is joined to Jesus Christ will be fully reconciled in heaven and will be in a place where we will fully trust each other. Because we'll know the other person isn't sinning. You won't need to think for a single moment in heaven, what's his ulterior motive for saying this? Is she putting a spin on the truth in that? No, we'll show each other great acts of love and kindness, and we won't be worrying about how other people take it. And they'll be kind to us, and we'll be able to receive it with gladness. Friends, we have a real hope of full reconciliation, not just with God, but with every believer as well. And thirdly, finally tonight, there's a hope in the future promised Saviour. And that's verses 22 to 26. We're told, verse 22, Joseph lives to be 110 years old. There's a lot of Egyptian writings that talk about that age, that say in Egyptian culture, that's a very respectful age to reach. So even in Egypt, Joseph is honoured by their standards. We're told he gets to see his grandchildren down to the third generation, in verse 23. Now, Joseph's hope as he dies, in some ways, it's similar to Jacob's hope. We said already, Joseph asks for his bones to be carried out of Egypt as well. And you can relate that back to what Jacob said too. It's similar. In fact, you read as you go on through the Bible, you read about how that's what happens. Those bones are carried out when the people leave Egypt. And then you read in the book of Joshua how he is finally laid to rest as God's people enter the promised land. And it's worth just noting in passing that can only really happen because he's been embalmed. He's been mummified, he says in verse 26. His body is preserved for hundreds of years until it can be properly buried. But Joseph also says something that Jacob doesn't say. And he repeats it. And whenever you see something that's repeated in the Bible, that's worth zooming in on. Here's what he repeats. Verse 24, he says, I am dying, but God will surely visit you. And verse 25 again, God will surely visit you. Now, when we talk about visiting, if I say I'm going to come and visit you, that doesn't mean I'm going to phone you. It doesn't mean I'm going to send you an email. It means I'm going to appear in person. It means we're actually going to see each other face to face. It means I'm going to come round your house and visit you. That's what it means. On one level, Joseph is simply saying that God will deliver them from Egypt and take these people to Canaan. We read this morning, Exodus 3, God visits Moses. He speaks to him in the burning bush and he leads them out of Egypt. But he's also looking further ahead than that too. His hope is in that first great hope of Genesis, the promised seed, the child of Eve who's going to crush death. And he understands how that's going to happen. God is going to come and visit us. He's going to come and be present in this world. Joseph's hope is the same as ours. It's in the God who has come to us. God has visited this earth in Jesus Christ, the child that Eve and Noah and Jacob and Joseph and all the saints of the Old Testament were waiting for. He's come. And he's delivered us from something far greater than slavery in Egypt. He's delivered us from our sin and our shame and our very own selves. Joseph needed that just as much as we do. Joseph was a great man, a faithful man, but he still faced death, and in that moment of death, his hope was God will come and visit you. Death is real for both these men. It's real for Jacob and for Joseph. Sometimes in our society, we don't even want to think about that or talk about it. We want to live just denying that the whole thing exists. We want to live just acting as if we will go on forever and ever. And this chapter is a dose of reality. Actually, unless Jesus returns first, every single person in this room will have that moment where it's for us. The Bible says it's appointed to man once to die. We each have our own appointment where it will be different for each of us. A date set for our death by God. So this chapter is a reminder for us to prepare for that day now. Now the Egyptians prepared for it. You know what the Egyptians did? They embalmed people. They wrapped them up as mummies. They put them in the tomb, but not just the mummies. You can read about Egyptian history and you see all those sorts of things they put in the tombs and the pyramids with them. They put things like games and furniture, even chariots and boats, because obviously you're going to need a chariot in the afterlife, they thought. Now we look at that and we think, how ridiculous. You can't take a chariot with you into the afterlife. And yet we still do the same sorts of things sometimes. We invest our time and our energies and our money into things that just won't last. That parable Jesus told, we tear down our barns and we build bigger ones to store all our grain. He says, you fool, this very night your life will be required of you. Chapters like this bring that home to us and remind us to prepare for that moment on our deathbeds now. Do you know, no one on their deathbed is going to say, I wish I put in even more hours at the office. I wish I kept up better with EastEnders on TV. I wish I kept up more to date with the celebrities and everything that's going on. You know, live now how you want to die. That's what Joseph does. That's what he's doing. In these words here, all he's doing is simply declaring what his hope has been for many years. Jesus says, labour for food that doesn't spoil. Store up for yourselves treasure in heaven. Because without Jesus, there is no hope of inheritance, no hope of reconciliation, either with God or others. Without Jesus, everything crumbles and disintegrates because it's him who holds everything in the world together. The whole point of the book of Genesis and of the story of Joseph and his brothers is when we trust in Jesus, we can look forward to a kingdom that death cannot devour. It points us towards Jesus who conquered death so that death does not conquer us. So that we're more than conquerors in Jesus Christ. I'm just going to close by reading to you the words of the first question of the Heidelberg Catechism. This is my favourite catechism, and the words of this are very moving, and these words are a good reminder for us of this. The catechism asks this question: what is your only comfort in life and in death? And the answer is quite long, but it's worth listening to. Here's the answer. That I am not my own, but belong, body and soul, in life and in death, to my faithful Saviour Jesus Christ. He has fully paid for all my sins with his precious blood, and has set me free from the tyranny of the devil. He also watches over me in such a way that not a hair can fall from my head without the will of my Father in heaven. In fact, all things must work together for my salvation. Because I belong to him, Christ, by his Holy Spirit, assures me of eternal life and makes me wholeheartedly willing and ready from now on to live for him. What is your only comfort in life and in death? That I'm not my own, but I belong to Christ. This chapter is brimming with hope. There is great hope in death when we know Jesus Christ. Well, we're going to close this part of the service now before we gather around the Lord's table. We're going to sing number 861. The sands of time are sinking, the dawn of heaven breaks. This is a hymn that looks forward to the future, to where we are heading if we're the Lord's. I'm going to stand and sing 861.